Nature and Role of Scientific Knowledge, Part 1, the seventh talk in a series on Foundations of Knowing the Truth, was presented by Charlie Dewberry on January 7, 1992, at McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2014. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side. The following recording was made in a classroom setting, and some of the students' questions were inaudible. It is hoped that Dr. Dewberry's answers will be sufficient to understand the context.
Well, first of all, I'm Charlie Dewberry, and this topic tonight is, for me, one that I think I enjoy this the most of all the ones I teach, and the reason is this class has kind of been right in the middle of one of my central struggles in trying to make sense out of something. And this will sound really strange, but it's specifically this topic that I started to wrestle with, and at the end of it, I became a Christian. So a very large part of my becoming a Christian is on this material, which will really seem strange. But hopefully by the end, that'll make some sense to you. So I'll mention just a little bit about my background to start with. I basically started out in high school and college prep classes, basically science prep and science. So I took a lot of chemistry, a lot of math. Oh, I remember calculus and all that stuff, and a lot of biology. My interest was really biology. When I got to undergrad, I basically did called a multiple disciplinary degree. My major was listed as political science, economics, and zoology. So those were my majors. Then I went to graduate school in aquatic ecology. So I got a master's in aquatic ecology. Then I came to Oregon State in the late 70s to do a PhD in stream ecology. And I was a PhD candidate and began to run into a lot of difficulties with the question, what is science and how do you do it? And on my way out to Oregon, I read two books, which I'll talk more about these books in the next 2 weeks. But I read two books on my way across the country. One was by Thomas Kuhn called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. And the other one was by Michael Polanyi called Personal Knowledge. Now, those two books were basically throwing rocks at everything I'd been taught. And they were basically dismissing everything I had been taught by page two, and then going on to present a new view. Well, Polanyi and Kuhn, as I read through them, presented a totally different view of science from even each other. So they were not only trashing everything that I believed, but they were presenting two views that were at opposite ends. And I suddenly realized in reading these two books that I had absolutely no tools, no clue as to how to think about this stuff, who was right. And later, I was a PhD candidate in ecology, and I had never had a philosophy class. It's amazing that there are very, very few scientists that are required to take a philosophy class. Well, actually, that question of what is science and how do you do it began to really bug me as I began to try to write a PhD thesis. And for various sundry reasons, when it came down to the end, I was not allowed to defend my PhD thesis, largely because of the view of science I had come to hold. And since then, I came to the University of Oregon while I went through the exegesis program here, and then I started a PhD program in philosophy of science here at the U of O. And the reason I did that is I think the question that was at stake wasn't scientific at all, but rather it was philosophical. And I came to realize that the fundamental questions that I was really interested in are, for the large part, mostly philosophical. So anyway, that's a fairly long autobiography for this, but I think as we work through this, that you'll begin to see a little bit of the struggle. I'm going to try to set it up as a struggle for you. a bit and let you work through it. And I'll stop for just a minute and say, is there anything anybody wants to ask or comment on at this point? Okay, if not, we'll jump right in. Just a question for me. How many people sat through the mini course I did last quarter on the role of knowledge? Okay, two, three. Okay, well, I'm going to start there. So what I'll do is basically just go through that, and I'll go through it fairly carefully. And so if you have any questions, please just jump in. What we started doing on the last mini course I did, the question was, how do we know? How is it that we know anything about the world, about ourselves, that kind of a question? And what I proposed is that basically, here is how we know. This is called epistemology. This is basically an epistemological answer. That's a part of philosophy. And as I work through this, well, when I get to the end of it, I'm going to try to run an example through. But what I'd like you to do is just follow it through and then think through the process and see if you agree that this is the way we do things and how we come to know. First, we begin what I would call, we begin with our pre-understanding. That is, everything that we already think is true. Well, we basically start there, meaning that as we live life and gain experience, there's all kinds of things we come to believe are true. And we start with those beliefs every time. If we didn't do that, I would argue knowledge would be very difficult for us ever to gain. So, for example, let's say, I don't know, something really bizarre happened. Let me see if I can think of something that would kind of really be bizarre that you wouldn't expect. Oh, let's say you're walking down a sidewalk and all of a sudden you notice a plastic Coke container just kind of laying on the along the edge of the grass, and as you walk by, it just collapses. And you look at that and go, huh, okay, when I walk by a Coke bottle, the act of my walking by collapses the Coke bottle. Well, that's a bizarre thought, but let's say you walk by another Coke bottle and it also just kind of collapses. As you kind of walk by, you see it collapse. Well, see, it sounds really bizarre to think, well, come on, wait a minute. There's no way you're going to claim that you're walking by this Coke bottle has any relationship to what's happening to the Coke bottle. Because, see, you know how the processes in the world work, and that's not a cause and effect relationship you've ever seen before. You can't explain it that way. You've learned and you assume how cause and effect work. And without that, we could never really gain any knowledge, because every event we would see that looked new or strange to us might cause us to reject all the beliefs that we really came to hold. So we would just randomly accumulate sets of beliefs that would just keep randomly kind of going in and out as we experience different things. But that's not what happens. We start out with beliefs, and once we come to the conclusion they're true, then we use them. And we basically, as we work our way through, we don't reject them unless we come up with a reason to reject them. And even these views that we have within our pre-understanding, there's a hierarchy of them, meaning that there's some we're going to hold with a lot greater assuredness than others. So, for example, we might decide and look at something like a clover, that most clovers have four leaves. We think clovers have four leaves. Well, it's not all that unusual that we might find a three-leaf clover. So if we find a three-leaf clover, are we not going to call it a clover because it's got three leaves? The answer is, well, we can say, okay, some clovers have three or four leaves. That's not a belief that we're really strongly hanging on to. But one, say, up here that we're really strongly hanging on to might be our belief in gravity. My hunch is that if something weird happens, like you see something go up, you're not likely to start by rejecting the notion that, oh, I get it, gravity doesn't work, there's something else. And so there's a hierarchy of all our beliefs that we bring. And so as we live life, there's a whole bunch of these things that we've come to believe and we use them. So right now when we begin this process, there's a ton of stuff we already know. And we begin with all of those beliefs. Now, in this process, we all of a sudden notice something that interests us. Well, the first comment I want to make is, if we didn't have this pre-understanding, how is it that we'd ever really notice that something really kind of interested us? One of the ways is, what we see isn't what we expected. You know, we might be walking along and all of a sudden just see something we didn't expect or we've never seen before. Or else we might be walking along and we might be thinking about something and go, wow, you know, this ought to be true and I never thought about that before, that this is a consequence of the beliefs I have and that's kind of new and different. Well, see, it's in the context of our beliefs that we notice something that interests us. And we notice it because it's either new compared to our other beliefs or it actually contradicts what we thought was going to be true. And so when we see something, like something that just doesn't fit, we may look at something and go, boy, I just can't explain that. I don't know what happened here. But yeah, I just would not expect that to be true. And when we find ourselves in that situation, we immediately try to come up with an explanation that will explain it. So what we have here is a case of we got the conclusions. We have the conclusion that something is true because we've seen it or we've experienced it. But our problem is what we believe to be true doesn't lead us to here. So we're kind of working backwards. And so I think what we do is we kind of run through a bunch of ideas. For instance, we go, well, let's see, it might be this. And then you go, no, that's not it. That's not going to work. Might be this. No. And all of a sudden you'll hit one and go, yeah, I'll bet that's it. I'll bet this is why this happens. And when that happens, we now have a possible explanation. So now, if it's something that's important to us, we might decide we're going to validate it or we're somehow going to test it and make sure it's true. So we'll set up some kind of little test, a little experiment. And when we do this experiment, it might be real simple, it might be really informal, it might even be just a thought experiment. But we'll do this little experiment and we'll think, now wait a minute, if this explanation's really true, then in this situation we ought to get this. But in this set of circumstances, we ought to get this. Now, is that the way it works? And if we think it is, depending on how important it is to us, we will set up an increasingly more sophisticated test. The more important it is to us, we'll set up a more strict kind of test to prove that this thing is true. And if it tests out okay, then we go, that's true. And so now, looking at this process as a whole, say I'm just walking along and I notice a tree and I go, huh, that's a strange tree. It looks like a sequoia. But sequoias don't live here. You don't find sequoias around here. They just don't grow in this part of Oregon. So you go up and look at it and it is in fact a sequoia. And you think, now geez, no, they aren't distributed here. So what could explain this? Well, a simple explanation is it's on the U of O campus, and although they're not natural here, somebody probably just planted this exotic tree here. I wouldn't have expected to ever find one here, but there's one here, and I think that's the explanation for it. Now, I think for the most part, we'd accept that. And we'd say, yeah, that's probably it. That's probably true. And so what I've set out here to argue is when we come down to it, everything we know in life, I think this is the method that we come to know it. So what I've outlined here is the method, I think, by which we come to know what's true. And so I'll stop for a minute since there's a lot of people that haven't heard it before. And see, does it kind of follow? I mean, does that sort of jive with your experience? If not, is there a problem?
You're suggesting that's the system that happens. It could result in right information or wrong information about the world.
Yes. And I'll make a comment on that right now. That's right. It could end up with a true belief or a false belief. And that could happen in several different ways. One is something in our pre-understanding was wrong. In other words, we started out with believing something that's actually not true. The second thing that could be wrong is we really made an error in logic when we worked our way through from our presuppositions to the conclusion that this was true. So we could have made an error in logic. The third thing is our tests might not have really been conclusive. We thought they were, but the test itself wasn't really conclusive. And so there's a lot of ways we can make errors. Those are the three big ones, though. And I'll leave it at those three. There may be another one, but off the top, those are the ones that come to mind. Yeah,
Keith. Isn't there some realm to where if someone sees something and validates their belief that they're holding on to the most, then they will make amends in their testing process, and they'll kind of hide things from themselves, or...
Well, yeah, that can happen. Yeah, basically when we come to this, when we come to that kind of a situation, I'll just make a comment on that is, see, one thing that's very important if you hold this view of how you come to know, you recognize that there's a lot of places you can go wrong. First one being things you're assuming here that are in your pre-understanding to start with, because we're going to do an experiment. In fact, I'm going to actually give you a question to work on next time. It's a very simple one. But I assume that everyone in here believes that the Earth goes around the Sun. What I want you to do is give me any evidence that you can come up with to show that's true. That's the question I'm going to give you. See, we all assume that the Earth goes around the Sun. Did I say that right first time?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. All of a sudden it sounded weird, so I thought maybe I tipped my hand or something, you know? No, but anyway, we all assume the Earth goes around the Sun. But why do you believe that? Have you actually seen it? So, for example, let's say we have two individuals. One person holds a Ptolemaic view, that is, that the Earth sets still and the Sun moves. Well, this person is talking to Copernicus. Copernicus believes the Sun sits still and the Earth turns. Well, imagine the dialogue here. Ptolemy comes out and says, "See, Copernicus, here comes the Sun. See, the Sun's moving." Copernicus goes, "No, Sun's sitting still. It's the Earth that's turning." Well, empirically, I think if you really think about it, your first thought is, Ptolemy is right. I mean, if I really think about it, I don't think the Earth moves. What evidence do I have? What real evidence do I have that the Earth moves? Well, see, this is the kind of issue that we get into here. Is where did our belief come from that the Earth goes around the Sun? Boy, we've heard it. But tell me where you got it. And I'll bet you can't. And so we've got thousands of beliefs that we have no clue where they came from. None at all. That we just assume are true. And they actually control what we see. I'll give you another example. This has always been a fun one for me. And some people that have been around here for a while, I can't believe they still come and listen to this thing. But the first time I really came to understand this process was I used to take folks on outbacks into the Rockies. And I really loved being in the Rockies and watching these thunderstorms. I mean, if you've ever been in the Rockies in the summer, I mean, the lightning will just shoot across the sky and it's light enough you can read books. It is just incredible to go through a huge thunderstorm in the Rockies. And you'll just see the lightning just shoot all over, hundreds of strings of lightning. And every once in a while you'll see it, boom, hit the ground and just explode when it hits the ground. And you'll just see it hit trees, and when it hits trees, you'll just see them smoke and then just pop and it just blows up. Well, I was on a trip like that once, and somebody said to me, "Think about the fact that lightning can actually go from the ground to the air." And my first response was, "You gotta be kidding me, lightning goes from the air to the ground." And that's the only way I'd ever seen it. Well, I looked, and sometimes lightning goes the other way. And for the first time in my life, I saw it. And I grew up in the Midwest. I'd seen lightning storms my whole life, but I had never seen lightning go from the ground to the air because I never thought about it. My pre-understanding so kind of conditioned me that that's what I saw. And so our presuppositions, our pre-understanding can incredibly impact what we see. It has that kind of power. But see, it doesn't have determinative power. So it doesn't determine what we can see, because if we consciously think about it, if we step back and say, "Now, wait a minute. I mean, does it logically make sense that it's a possibility that lightning could go the other way?" well, gee, yeah, I think so. I'd never thought about it. And so it seems logically possible with everything else I believe. So let's see if it's true. And lo and behold, we actually see it. Now, the interesting thing to me is on those trips, there were always people who couldn't see it. They would swear to their last day that lightning always goes from the air to the ground. They'd never see it the other way. Well, I don't know why that's the case, but something motivates them. There's something that motivates them to hang on, to want to hang on to that notion it only goes one way, even though it doesn't. So having a grasp of this process, I think, has some real implications. First, what I want to argue is this whole process really occurs tacitly, meaning we don't think about it. It just naturally occurs. But secondly, it is a process that we can examine, that we can think about. We can gain skill in doing this process. We can consciously work through the steps and see if it makes sense. And so we can learn to do this process better. Now, another set of implications for this are that we realize now that our presuppositions have a real powerful effect on what we even see. And so we also know, as we mentioned before, that we can make mistakes even in our logic or working our way through. So whenever we claim to know anything, I think we have to recognize that we really need to be careful how rigidly and how strongly we really hang on to certain beliefs and ask ourselves really why it is that we hang on to these beliefs as tightly as we do. We need to examine that. We need to examine what kind of justification we have for hanging on to those. So I think those are most of the comments I'd like to make. That was basically, you basically got about a 15 to 20 minute lecture on what I spent 3 hours talking about last time. So I know that's covering a lot of stuff, so I don't know if you got most of it or not, but are there any questions about that part or anything? Anybody wants to chime in? Okay. Now, what I've just explained is the method by which I think we know everything that we come to know, at least about things in the world, anyway. So now I'd like to shift gears a little bit and ask what this thing called science is. I think all of us have a view of science. And most people, and this is especially true for scientists, I think, is they believe that what a scientist does is fundamentally different from what anybody else does. So when we think about a scientist, we think about somebody working in a lab or doing kind of rigidly done experiments with a particular method. We think that because this person is so highly trained and because they use this method so carefully and rigidly, that because they use this method, that the results they get are more objective and they're more certain. And I think that's the view that most of us have. So, for example, when we go to buy a car, we can go ask a few people what they think about particular brands of cars. We can just randomly walk around down on the street, or else we can pick up consumer reports, or there's several private testing agencies out there. And so we can actually go to those, and we assume that they have greater reliability and objectivity because they've used a different kind of method to come to their results. Now, what I want to say is, I think that's a question we need to examine, and we're going to need to examine carefully. But I think that's the view that most of us have when it comes to science. That if you want to know something about the world, it's the scientists you're going to go ask. Because they use this scientific method, they're basically more objective. Their biases don't get in here. They don't have the problems that other people have. And so I think that's the view we have coming into this question of what is science and how do you do it. So what I would like to move to now is, what's the relationship of science, then, to our ordinary way of knowing that I've already just talked about? And what I want to argue is that in our culture at this time, scientists are really the apostles of truth. When you get right down to it, in the culture and society we live in, when you get right down to ground zero, it's the science. Scientists are the experts that are going to tell us how the world works. they hold the fundamental truths within this culture. Now, what evidence do I have for that? I'll present a little bit of evidence, work our way through just the historical situation for a minute, and then I'll come back at the end and talk a little bit about the relationship between science and philosophy and religion in our culture and some things that have happened in the 20th century. So the first thing I want to do as I look at this is I'm going to argue that it hasn't always been true that scientists are put on the pedestal as the real holders of truth. If you go back to Greece, scientists were there and scientists held some truth, but other people did as well, like philosophers. I mean, philosophers were looked at as kind of pretty good paradigm for holders of truth. And so the method that philosophers would use could get you truth. But what we argue, what we're told, or at least what I've always been told, is, yeah, but the rise of modern science transformed humanity. And the rise of modern science started with Copernicus, really. Because the argument is, simplistically, how the argument goes, at least a very common one that I've heard is, to the medievals it was the theologians that were the holders of truth. They were the apostles of truth. So the method that they would use, that's how you got truth. And so, see, their method, it really didn't work very well because they thought that religion and specifically Christianity and the Bible actually would give them truth about stuff in science. Like, for example, they look at Genesis, and according to them, the Bible claims the sun goes around the earth, and that's what they believed, and that was good enough for them. But see, with Copernicus and with the rise of this new system, see, it's science that showed us that it's the earth that goes around the sun. And so if we set aside that old methodology, and if we recognize that the old apostles of truth, the theologians, that see, they've got axes to grind, they've got presuppositions, they've got beliefs they want to hang on to with no empirical evidence at all. And so see, these new scientists, science sets aside all those biases and allows us to go out and see reality as it really is. And that's the foundation of the scientific method. And so as we see science developed, it gets more and more specialized, it gets us more and more understanding, it gets us more and more truth about all areas of the physical world. And so, like I say, we live at a time where when we think about the real holders of truth and knowledge, yeah, it's science. I mean, think of astronomy now. Think of biology, geology. What is it that you want to know about human beings? Ask social scientists. Yeah, socials will tell you all about human beings. And until they really do their work, we don't really know. I mean, science hasn't answered those questions yet. And I think that for most of the 20th century, that has been the view of science in its role in society and culture. So, as I said, science has become the predominant method for knowledge. Okay, what's an implication of this? Well, first of all, science now has even become the foundation for philosophy. And so, in fact, most of the 20th century, there was a view of science called logical positivism, which their objective really was to take empirical data and write a new language. And this new language would fix all our problems. It would express only things that we could empirically know, and it would fix our language so meaningless terms or stuff we couldn't know empirically couldn't enter in. So, for example, in this view, if this may strike you a little strange, well, the second example, the first example is they'd say, well, okay, let's start. The term angel. You ever seen one? You ever touched one? Ever talked to one? So you don't have any empirical evidence. That's a meaningless concept. You can think about it. But when it comes to whether it has meaning or whether it's true, it doesn't really make any sense. And actually, a very strange part of this argument would be atoms. You ever seen an atom? You ever touched it? See, according to most of the group that was in this process, even an atom is a meaningless word. because you don't have any empirical data. So anything you don't have an empirical data for, just put in a blip, because it's not real. Just something, it's a concept. It's a construct. You've made it up. And you don't have any evidence that that made-up term is real. So their whole project for most of the 20th century was essentially to make science even the foundation for philosophy. And so now, what happens to all other kinds of subject matter that can't be investigated by science like religion? Well, those are just beliefs and things that you can believe if you want to, but hey, come on, that's just faith and that's just stuff over here. But see, that's not related to truth, because truth you only know empirically. That's how you know. And basically, this kind of view, well, up until the late 1950s, that was the view of the science community, most of the philosophy community in the United States. And I can attest that that kind of view is alive and very well yet in a lot of science communities. So, having said that, let's look at this special method called the scientific method, which the claim is made that it's unique and it's going to provide us with this objective and detached way of looking at things. First, science begins with a hypothesis. Now, my hypothesis might be that, well, let's use the one that we're going to use. Let's start out with a hypothesis. Well, actually, let's not start with that one, because I want you to think about that. The parts of that I want you to think about. Let's start out with that all plants need nitrogen. So our hypothesis is that all plants need nitrogen. Now, that's what we're going to investigate. We're going to set up an experiment and see if this is true. First, what kind of deductions could be derived from this hypothesis? Okay, one case would be if there's no nitrogen, plants won't grow. Another deduction from this would be that increasing nitrogen would result in increasing plant growth to a point. And the point is, of course, when they get all they need, it doesn't matter if you give them more or not. That would be a deduction that would kind of follow from this hypothesis. So anyway, you put together a whole kind of string of these, but we'll just take a couple. Now what you do is you test this hypothesis with what's called a null hypothesis. Okay, now this will seem like a very strange process and kind of convoluted, at least to me. But here's the rationale. Follow it through. It's going to take us three steps before you'll understand why scientists do this. So just bear with me as we follow it through. Okay, the null hypothesis would be here that with no nitrogen, plants will grow. Okay, the null hypothesis is basically the opposite of the deduction, or the opposite of what's up here. So without any nitrogen, the null hypothesis is without any nitrogen, plants will grow. So we set up a bunch of experiments. And so let's say we do 10 experiments. And when there's no nitrogen, plants do not grow. So we do the experiment 10 times, and 10 times we get this result. So basically what we've done is we set up this experiment, and with no nitrogen, plants do not grow. So in every case we did our experiment, our null hypothesis was false. Does everybody see how that works? So all 10 times we did our experiment, it turned out false. Well, so here's what we can say. We can say we know the null hypothesis is true. We know the null hypothesis is false. Therefore, we can reject it. And so, for right now, we can accept this statement as having been tested. It's not proved. Because, see, to actually prove something in this view, you'd have to do an N number of these experiments. I mean, there's always a chance that these results somehow, there's something else at stake, or it possibly just happened randomly, it turned out this way.
You'd have to test every possible null hypothesis.
You'd have to test every possible null hypothesis before you could claim that this statement was true. So, in this view, nothing can be proven true. You can only falsify your null hypotheses. And as a result, this is how progress comes. So So by setting up these experiments and falsifying beliefs, you basically begin to accumulate hypotheses that have been tested. And this empirical accumulation of tested hypotheses, this is the progress of science. Okay, so this is what progress is in science. Okay, now, for those of you with a science background, is that pretty much what you heard for most of your education? Yeah, Vince? Yeah, anybody else? Science? Done a fair amount of science? Okay, then for next time, I'd like to outline a couple things I'd like you to think about. And we're going to come back and spend a bit of time with this next time. First, what differences are there between the traditional model of science and the method of knowing I outlined? So, in the first, right at the beginning, I outlined what I consider to be the method of how we know. And then item four is the scientific method, what I call the traditional version of that. So what I'd like you to do next time is maybe just look at those two and see how many things you can pull out that are different. Secondly, start thinking about how you're going to reconcile any differences you see. How is it possible you can put the two together? See, so what I'm saying is try to find a way you can reconcile this traditional view of how science works with the view I outlined. And as I say, no one seemed to object to the view I articulated at the beginning. And so if that is the way we think it works, then we may have a problem here. What I would like to do is think about how you would reconcile those two things. And now, I want to come to a very simple experiment. When you come right down to it, this is one of the simplest things you could probably ever determine in a lot of ways. And it's basically the astronomy example that I started with. All we got, just limit yourself to two planets. Let's just use, make it one planet even. One planet. Let's just say the Earth and the Sun. Try to tell me how it is that you're sure. What evidence do you have that one or the other moves? This notion is called relative motion. And an even simpler way to think about it is, I'll give you a bit of a hint. Let's say you've got two boats. Let's say and you think both of them are moving. How is it you could actually really tell whether one's moving or not? The obvious answer is, you've got to look at the water. I mean, you can kind of tell when you look at the water because the water is what's stable here. So, I mean, obviously if this boat up here kind of has a weight coming out of it, and this one doesn't, and this one seems to be moving this direction relative to this one, then, okay, that's easy. We can all figure that kind of thing out. But see, the question I'm raising is now let's ask the same question relative to the Earth. Because what I'm raising here is maybe the water is moving relative to the Earth. And so how could you tell by being in the boats whether or not one of them or the other is moving relative to the Earth? Do you see the question? Okay, tell me how you can figure it out. Again, very, very simple question.
The mast will start to go lower and lower, but you have to be at a stationary point.
Well, you're out on the water, you can't see land.
Well,
you're just out on the open water.
If you're behind them, though, if you're in one of them.
You're in one of them. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're on one of the boats. And the question I'm asking is, tell me relative to the Earth, which one is moving faster? You kind of see the question? Well, anyway, that's the kind of question that I'd like to talk about the next couple weeks. And as I say, if that's difficult, something this simple, if it's that hard to figure that out, now think about some relatively harder questions. See, this is the thing that I think that very few scientists are ever aware of. And actually very few of us, until we start thinking about this, that we all know the kind of answers to the Earth and the Sun. But like I say, why do we know it? And I'm going to argue that I think for the large part we know it because somebody told us. But who is it and how do they know? So anyway, I'd like to stop here and say those are the kinds of things we'll come back and talk about next time. And that's it.